This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in تخفوا ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ يَوْمَ تَجِدُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ مُحْضَرًا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: Joe Biden declares victory in the U.S. presidential election, promising to heal a divided America and making the U.S. respected around the world again. U.S. President Trump says the election is far from over, accusing Joe Biden of rushing falsely to pose as the winner of the presidential vote. Also ahead, Palestinians slam Israel's latest demolition of Palestinian houses in the West Bank, urging the International Criminal Court to bring Israeli war criminals to justice. Welcome to the program. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has delivered his victory speech among his supporters in the state of Delaware, pledging to heal a divided America.
For all those of you who voted for President Trump, I understand the disappointment tonight. I've lost a couple times myself, but now let's give each other a chance. It's time to put away the harsh rhetoric. Lower the temperature, see each other again, listen to each other again. And to make progress, we have to stop treating our opponents as our enemies. They are not our enemies, they are Americans.
Biden promised to make the United States respected around the world again, vowing to tackle climate change and systemic racism in the country. Several U.S. news networks, including the Associated Press, CNN, and Fox News, declared Biden and the 46th U.S. president as the 46th U.S. president after he extended his lead in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. His electoral vote count now stands at 290, surpassing the 270 needed to enter the White House. Biden supporters poured onto the streets in front of the White House and several other cities to celebrate the win. Trump, however, has repeatedly made allegations of election fraud and vowed to challenge the result in courts. He's challenged the results in several states. In a statement, Trump said Biden is rushing falsely to pose as the winner of the election and the election that is far from over. Trump's latest lawsuit was filed in Arizona, where he alleges that Maricopa County incorrectly rejected votes cast by in-person voters on Election Day. All America's allies are sending congratulatory messages to U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, signaling they will not back incumbent President Donald Trump's refusal to accept the election results. German Chancellor and the French President, as well as the Canadian Prime Minister, separately congratulated Biden. The trio, who had strained relations with Trump, called for cooperation with the U.S. against what they called great global challenges. The British and Japanese Prime Ministers also said they look forward to working with Biden's government. The British Prime Minister specifically named climate change a thorny issue Trump dismissed as a hoax. However, Mexico's president, who has a good personal relation with Trump, said it is too soon to congratulate Biden. Andrés Manuel López said he would wait for resolution of what he called all legal issues in the U.S. election. Political commentator Mr. Lawrence Davidson says U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is now faced with the challenge of bringing together a divided America.
So there's a couple of things that we have to watch for. One is the divisiveness and essentially what will Trump's fanatical followers do. There's no chance of them taking power. There's going to be no coup or anything like that. But in fact, there might be sporadic episodes of violence that will have to be dealt with. So we've got to watch for the divisiveness and the sporadic violence that is likely. Now, in terms of domestic policy, we've all, escaped domestic barbarism for the next 4 years. And it's in foreign policy that we can look for some significant changes.
Iran's first vice president, Ishaq Jahangiri, has expressed hope for a change in what he calls America's destructive policies following Joe Biden's victory in the U.S. presidential election. Jahangiri tweeted that he hopes for a return of the U.S. to law and international commitments. He said the era of U.S. President Donald Trump and, quote, his adventurous and warmongering team has come to an end. The top official said Iran withstood Trump's maximum pressure campaign. Jahangiri, however, noted that the Iranian nation will not forget the pain caused by the U.S. administration. Trump pulled the U.S. out of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal with world powers 3 years ago and imposed tough sanctions on the nation. Palestinian Foreign Ministry has called on the European Union to impose sanctions to force Israel to stop demolishing Palestinian homes. In a statement, the ministry condemned Israel's latest demolition of Palestinian houses in the West Bank as a breach of international law and the Geneva Conventions. The statement urged the international community to punish Israel for its, quote, heinous crime in order to prevent it from committing similar crimes. It also called on International Criminal Court to immediately launch an investigation and bring Israeli war criminals to justice. Earlier this week, Israeli bulldozers demolished an entire village in the Jordan Valley, leaving some 80 Palestinians homeless. Meanwhile, a Palestinian prisoner who had been on a hunger strike for over 100 days since he was arrested by the Israeli military forces has ended his strike following an agreement with Israeli authorities to release him late this month. Ruba Shabit is in Gaza.
Maher al-Akhras, a Palestinian inmate at Israeli jail, has suspended his hunger strike that lasted for over 100 days and won his freedom after forcing Israeli regime to release him. The Palestinian Prisoners Committee in the Gaza Strip marked this victory during a press conference in front of the Red Cross office and stressed that the Palestinian resistance will continue till all Palestinian inmates at Israeli jails are freed.
Maher al-Akhras' long hunger strike showed the Palestinians' patience and resistance. Today we're celebrating this victory. Maher's resistance led to his release amid the silence of the international community.
The 49-year-old Palestinian prisoner, a father of six, was detained on July 27 and held under a four-month administrative detention order with no charge and based on alleged secret evidence not available even to his lawyers. He went on hunger strike to protest his arrest and condition.
Release of Maher al-Akhras is a victory not only for him but also for all Palestinians. Hunger strike is an effective means of resistance in the face of the Israeli administrative detention policies.
The Palestinian man would spend the remaining period of his current term in hospital for medical treatment.
Maher al-Akhras's health condition is still unstable. His victory reveals the violation of Palestinians' rights and provides us with more energy to work harder to free all Palestinian detainees from Israeli jails.
There are currently 350 Palestinian detainees in Israeli prisons without charge. The Palestinian Commission of Detainees Affairs said earlier this week, three of them have been on hunger strike in solidarity with Akhras.
Maher al-Akhras held one of the longest hunger strikes that led to his release. There are thousands of Palestinian inmates who suffer at Israeli jails. Al-Akhras' victory reminds the international community of the urgency to save the life of those inmates.
Maher al-Akhras has ended his hunger strike at Israeli jails after 100 days when the Zionist regime was finally forced to release him, marking another victory for the Palestinian cause. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Israelis have held fresh demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem al-Quds. Protesters gathered outside Netanyahu's residence to condemn his policies and call for his resignation. Scuffles broke out after several people were arrested. Demonstrations came despite a ban on protests. Israelis have been staging street rallies over the past months to protest soaring unemployment, a hike in COVID-19 infections, and a return of coronavirus restrictions. Adding to anti-regime sentiments are the corruption charges facing the prime minister. Netanyahu went on trial in May for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, but he denies any wrongdoing. Moving on with the coronavirus pandemic that surges across Europe, with several countries reporting new record highs in the number of infections and fatalities. Sadly, Italy registered nearly 40,000 cases, the highest ever daily tally since the pandemic began there. The UK officials said daily infections rose by almost 25,000. Austria posted a record high number of more than 8,400 infections and nearly 30 deaths. Death toll surpassed the 40,000 mark in France, where over 1.6 million cases have been reported. In Poland, the health ministry announced a record number of nearly 28,000 cases, bringing the total infections to over 500,000. Czech Republic confirmed more than 11,500 new cases, raising its total tally to more than 403,000. Meanwhile, Iran has reported another single-day record for coronavirus infections. Health Ministry spokeswoman Sima Sadat-Dari said more than 9,400 people contracted the disease in the last 24 hours, bringing the total number of cases to over 673,000. The country also reported 423 new fatalities in the same period. That takes the total number of deaths to almost 38,000. Number of deaths and infections has been on the rise in Iran. The country has reported several new highs since September. Officials have implemented restrictive measures, including a ban on travel in and out of five major cities.
Coronavirus pandemic would spiral out of control. This is a demand made by Tehran City Council, as well as some MPs, amid an unabated surge in infections and fatalities. As the coronavirus has resurged over the past month across Iran, experts have raised the alarm over the soaring figures, especially in the densely populated capital.
Currently, there are over 32,000 hospitalized COVID patients. Out of this figure, 6,800 are in critical conditions and kept in ICUs. Our medical system has for the past 9 months been under severe pressure. Our medical workers are tirelessly working to fight the virus.
Last week, the government doubled down on its COVID restrictions, banning and imposing fines on unnecessary intercity travels. The government has also extended remote work for civil servants and mandated mask wearing, fining those who go out without a face mask.
The government is not doing enough to contain the virus. It keeps advising people to stay home while ignoring the fact that those people need to work to handle their families' expenses. The government should provide taxi drivers and others like us with handouts enough for a month-long expenditure. This way, we can afford staying home.
Some people seem to be still unaware of the gravity of the crisis. The law enforcement should take strict measures to stop them from roaming around in parks and other public places. As long as apathetic citizens are not facing punishment, the virus is here to stay.
Over the past 2 months, coronavirus fatalities in Iran have more than quadrupled, with the latest figures hovering about 400. Since the outbreak of the virus in the country, plus 660,000 have tested positive, and more than 37,000 have lost their lives. The health ministry says it has proposed a 2-week enforced lockdown in the capital as the last shot in bringing the soaring numbers to a halt.
As the resurging virus continues to claim more lives, experts say it's still too soon to pin hope on a treatment or a vaccine. They say prevention is still the only weapon against the virus, on the condition that everyone is armed with that weapon. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Moving on, the World Health Organization says several countries have reported coronavirus cases cropping up among farmed minks. According to the organization, the United States, Italy, the Netherlands, Sweden, Spain, and Denmark have reported such cases. The WHO said it will review the biosafety of mink farms worldwide. Meanwhile, the Danish government announced that a variant of COVID-19 found in minks has been transmitted to 12 people. It said the government would organize the euthanization of all minks in Denmark. The Danish government has already responded to the threat posed by the mutated coronavirus by starting the culling of 17 million minks and shutting down the entire mink industry in the country. The country is preparing to mass test hundreds of thousands of people in some regions. In other news, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called for a peaceful resolution of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia. In a phone call with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, Erdogan said that Yerevan must be convinced to negotiate regarding the conflicts with Baku. Erdogan called for Armenia's withdrawal from the Azeri lands it is occupying. Earlier, Armenia reported clashes with Azerbaijani forces near the town of Shusha in the disputed region. Baku has, however, rejected the claim. So far, 3 ceasefire agreements have been reached between the warring sides, but they have all failed to hold. At least 1,000 people have died in nearly 6 weeks of fighting in and around Nagorno-Karabakh. Kashmiris have called on the international community to intervene in the disputed region of Jammu and Kashmir to bring an end to the alleged continuing atrocities being committed by Indian security forces in the region. Javed Rana is in Islamabad.
These protesters gathered in Islamabad to observe November 6 as a black day against India. On this very day, back in 1947, over 200,000 Muslims in disputed Jammu and Kashmir were killed by Indian forces. New Delhi carried out alleged genocide while forcibly occupying Muslim-majority state of Jammu and Kashmir. Allahu Akbar! This followed a war between Pakistan and India in 1948, and Pakistan, with the help of local Muslim population, took over the control of an estimated 100,000 square kilometer territory, which is now known as Azad Kashmir and Gilgit-Baltistan. 7 decades after, India last year abolished the autonomy of parts of Kashmir region under its control and formally merged the disputed region into its federation. Since then, the life is far from normal in the disputed territory.
It's definitely an act of genocide, a death warrant against unarmed, defenseless people of Indian-occupied Jammu and Kashmir. It's a repetition of 1947, 6 of November. They were not in government in 1947, if you recall. But now they're in thumping majority. And Modi is just a front man of the RSS ideology of Hindutva.
Last year's merger of disputed territory was in defiance of 11 UN Security Council resolutions which call for the plebiscite to let people of Kashmir decide on whether they want to stay with India or join neighboring Pakistan.
India's illegal and unilateral actions of 5th August 2019 have been rejected by the Kashmiri people, by Pakistan, as well as by the international community for being in violation of international law and the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Deepening humanitarian crisis in IIOJK, a scar on the collective conscience of the world community.
There is no let up to the human rights abuses such as killing of unarmed civilians and enforced disappearances. Nonetheless, the mass human rights violations have attracted little global attention given the geostrategic and economic interest of Western powers in India. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary. O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. and exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The United States is the worst affected nation in the world by COVID-19, with more than 10.2 million confirmed cases and a death toll of more than 243,000. The country's coronavirus outbreak was a key policy battleground in the run-up to the November 3rd election and contributed to a surge in postal and early in-person voting. Also, the second coronavirus wave has plowed on relentlessly throughout Europe, which reported more than 12 million cases and about 301,000 deaths as swathes of Italy returned to lockdown and the British city of Liverpool trialled city-wide testing on Saturday. According to an Agence France-Presse tally of health authority figures, the continent has become the new epicenter of the pandemic, and a total of 301,000 deaths have been reported in Europe since the COVID-19 virus first hit. Two-thirds of these fatalities have been registered in the United Kingdom, Italy, France, Spain, and Russia. We now present you a report written by staff writers of the Financial Times, as well as Agence France-Presse, under the heading U.S. Hits Record Daily Coronavirus Case Rise 3 Days Running. Europe deaths exceed 300,000. Please stay with us for more. According to Johns Hopkins University, the United States reported a third straight daily record of new coronavirus cases on Saturday, whilst Europe's death toll surpassed 301,000. More than 127,000 infections were reported in 24 hours, as well as about 1,160 deaths. The news comes as officials announced that White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows had tested positive for the coronavirus. He is the latest official in the U.S. administration of Donald Trump to contract the disease. The U.S. is the worst affected nation in the world by COVID-19, with more than 10.2 million confirmed cases and a death toll of more than 243,000. It was not immediately clear how Mark Meadows, who has often appeared at public events without wearing a face mask, was infected. According to the New York Times, he first tested positive on Wednesday. The New York Times said Trump's election campaign advisor, Nick Traynor, also has tested positive for the virus. Mark Meadows traveled with the president on the final days of campaigning and was an election night party attended by dozens of Trump supporters at the White House. The country's coronavirus outbreak was a key policy battleground in the run-up to the November 3rd presidential election and contributed to a surge in postal and early in-person voting. In late October, Mark Meadows said in an interview with CNN that the United States was not going to control the pandemic, saying that COVID-19 could only be defeated by mitigation areas like vaccines and therapeutics. Donald Trump and his wife Melania and son Barron all contracted and recovered from COVID-19, as did the National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, the senior advisor Stephen Miller, and the White House counselor Hope Hicks. A ceremony at the White House on 26th of September came into focus after the president contracted the virus. More than a dozen reporters, guests, and officials at the crowded Rose Garden event, where Donald Trump formally announced Amy Coney Barrett as his pick for the Supreme Court, contracted the virus. Video footage captured attendees standing close together without wearing face masks. Some shook hands, bumped fists, and even hugged. The second coronavirus wave has plowed on relentlessly throughout Europe, which reported more than 12 million cases and about 301,000 deaths, as swathes of Italy returned to lockdown and the very city of Liverpool trialed citywide testing on Saturday. According to an Agence France-Presse tally of health authority figures, the European continent has become the new epicenter of the pandemic, and a total of 301,000 deaths have been reported in Europe since the COVID-19 virus first hit. Two-thirds of these fatalities have been registered in the United Kingdom, Italy, France, Spain, and Russia. As countries race to try to curb their spiking cases, they impose new lockdowns despite signs of growing unrest, with several Italian regions shutting down and Greeks facing fresh stay-at-home orders from Saturday. In Italy, a lockdown was ordered for prosperous Lombardy region, fellow northern regions Piedmont and Val d'Aosta, as well as one southern region, Calabria. Giorgio Gori, the mayor of the northern city of Bergamo, the epicenter of Italy's coronavirus crisis earlier this year, said, "There is more tiredness and more distrust around than during the first lockdown, after people protested outside his home." The head of the infectious diseases department at Milan's renowned Luigi Sacco Hospital, Massimo Galli, told reporters he was alarmed by the situation and had been ever since the end of Italy's first lockdown in May. Massimo Galli said, "I've always confirmed that you have to keep on high alert to avoid the return of problems," he added. "I'm sick of saying the same thing again, like the voice screaming in the desert without any acknowledgement." Governments are desperately trying to find alternatives to lockdowns, which hammer the economy. In England, which has also shut down, the northwestern city of Liverpool on Friday began the country's first citywide coronavirus testing program. All 500,000 residents will be offered repeat tests, even if asymptomatic, under a pilot scheme that could be rolled out nationwide if successful. British MPs have resoundingly voted to support Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan for a month lockdown, which began on Thursday, 5th of November. The government kept a rebellion by recalcitrant Conservative MPs at the House of Commons at bay to win by a staggering 516 votes to 38, a majority of 478. The vote means that as of Thursday, 5th of November, hotels, coffee shops, restaurants, non-essential shops have all closed across England, and stay shut until 2nd of December. People also were told to stay at home, apart from when attending school, college, university, work, or to go shopping for food and other essential items. The latest lockdown effectively replaces the three-tier system of regional restrictions across England for 4 weeks, after which the tiers will be reimposed. Before the vote, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson cancelled MPs that a second lockdown was required to contain the surge of COVID-19 cases. Johnson warned in dramatic style that, absent immediate action, Britain could expect deaths on its grievous scale, with hospitals in extraordinary trouble by as early as next month. During a three-hour debate in the House of Commons, Conservative rebels, in addition to a handful of Labour MPs from the northwest of England, tried to push back against the Prime Minister's plan, largely on economic and personal liberty grounds. Graham Brady, the chair of the powerful 1922 Committee of Tory backbenchers, told the House of Commons he would vote against the lockdown with greater conviction than any other vote he had cast in his 23 years in Parliament. Sir Graham Brady claimed, "The thing that troubles me most is that the government is reaching too far into the private and family lives of our constituents." Former Prime Minister Theresa May opposed Boris Johnson's plan on the grounds that COVID-19 cases in Liverpool, a hotspot for the coronavirus infections, is supposedly falling. Theresa May's position was supported by former Tory leader Ian Duncan Smith, who questioned the data behind the Prime Minister's proposed second lockdown. Ian Duncan Smith was also critical of the appalling leak of the government's lockdown plan to the media before its official announcement. But despite the vociferous opposition from senior Conservatives, Boris Johnson remained resolute in the House of Commons, proclaiming that he's not prepared to take the risk with the lives of British people. The vote in the House of Commons took place on the day that a further 25,200 people tested positive for COVID-19 in the United Kingdom, accompanied by 500 confirmed coronavirus-related deaths. Meanwhile, the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, has launched a stinging attack on the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, accusing him of underestimating the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Speaking at the Confederation of British Industry CBI conference on Monday, 2nd of November, Keir Starmer directly blamed Rishi Sunak for the severe economic cost of the late lockdown. Starmer proclaimed, "Make no mistake, the Chancellor's name is all over this." Keir Starmer added, his decision to block a circuit breaker lockdown, to dismiss it as a blunt instrument and to pretend that you can protect the economy without controlling the virus will now mean that businesses have to close for longer, more people will lose their jobs, and the public finances will be worse than they need to be. The Labour leader urged the Chancellor to set out a full package of support, in keeping with what was offered during the first lockdown in spring, to ease the pain of shutting down the bulk of the economy. The Labour leader also used the occasion to address wider issues relating to the lockdown, including the protection of the country's core infrastructure. According to Keir Starmer, the four-week lockdown must be used to fix, test, trace and isolate, and to give control to local authorities, to get a grip on messaging and rebuild public trust, and to provide a clear and transparent roadmap to protect businesses and the National Health Service over the months to come. Starmer's stinging attack on Chancellor Rishi Sunak and the government was all the more striking as Prime Minister Boris Johnson dropped out of speaking at the same event, the Confederation of British Industry CBI conference. Instead, Business Secretary Alok Sharma addressed the CBI audience and admitted that a fully functioning vaccine may never materialize. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Europe, Denmark defended the strict measures it has imposed on the northwest of the country after a mutated version of the new coronavirus linked to mink farms was found in humans. Copenhagen has warned that the mutation could threaten the effectiveness of any future vaccine and has ordered the slaughter of all of the country's minks, estimated at up to 17 million. Danish Foreign Minister Jeppe Kofod said these are timely and necessary measures amid a worrying development. Meanwhile, Greece's second nationwide shutdown drew the ire of teachers as it closes down secondary schools and universities. Theodoros Souchlos, the president of the Secondary School Teachers Union, said many high school students had already fallen behind during the first wave of the virus. He added the second lockdown could raise inequalities further, as some students don't have access to Wi-Fi or own a laptop, or else it is used by parents for teleworking. He said these are issues that the government should have prepared for during the summer, but instead it acted as if everything was under control. People rushed to get a haircut before the Saturday shutdown, even though hairdressers are allowed to open for two more days. The coronavirus has been mercilessly hitting Switzerland, and in particular its French-speaking region, where hospitals are rapidly becoming overwhelmed. At one small hospital, patients with severe COVID-19 infections filled all 10 enclosed beds. The pandemic has killed at least 1,256,000 people since it first emerged in China late last year, out of more than 50.3 million confirmed infections. Data shows economic growth slowing down in Britain, particularly in the services sector last month. The UK economy is headed for a double-dip recession this winter. According to the latest IHS Market CIPS monthly survey of the services sector, which is equal to three-quarters of economic activity, a recovery over the summer stalled in October increased additional pressure on the Bank of England to improve its stimulus programme when officials met on Thursday, 5th of November. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee's meeting considered a big injection of funds to support the economy. Whilst this was regarded as an unlikely prospect only a few weeks ago, most city analysts have projected a £100 billion rise in quantitative easing, where the Bank of England injects money into the economy by acquiring government debt from financial institutions. IHS Markit says several months of declining consumer confidence in Britain, which has tracked the increase in the number of coronavirus cases, decreased demand for hotels and restaurants, whilst the government's policy of tiered lockdowns effectively stopped a return to the office across much of the country. The Purchasing Managers Index PMI for the services sector, which includes industries ranging from retail to hospitality and financial services, fell to 51.4 in October from 56.1 in September to come in below the consensus reach among city analysts and an earlier flash estimate of 52.3. The composite Purchasing Managers Index PMI, which encompasses the manufacturing sector, dropped to 52.1 from 56.5 in September. IHS Economics Director Tim Moore said the data collected between 12th and 28th of October, before the second nationwide lockdown was imposed, showed the economy seems on course for a double-dip recession this winter and a far more challenging path to economic recovery next year in 2021. Two successive quarters of negative growth, which happened in the first 6 months of 2020, equals a recession, with the term double-dip, which is used to describe two downturns in quick succession. The Purchasing Managers Index report said employment across the services sector decreased for the eighth consecutive month, whereas customer-facing service providers, especially those in hotels, restaurants and catering establishments, faced a slump. new orders declined for the first time since June. Tim Moore said a lack of forward bookings in parts of the economy most affected by lockdown measures led to widespread reports of redundancies and another sharp fall in the total employment numbers during October. Samuel Toombs, the chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said markets survey suggests the recovery essentially ground to a halt in October. Samuel Toombs said the effect would be disclosed in lower gross domestic product growth, which would stay around 8% below its pre-COVID peak at the end of the year. Samuel Toombs, the chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said October was a turning point on several fronts, asserting that a dramatic fall in the use of public and private transport and a drop in demand for discretionary consumer services contributed to a wider shutdown.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran by a shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
To all the ones I love, I'm sorry I could not take it anymore, so it is time for me to go where the sun is always sunny and the grass is always green and the flowers smell like honey. Levi left us a letter. My mother found it. It, to me, it's the most precious gift that he gave me. When my son was over there after Operation Anaconda, they had to clean up landmines that were left around Bagram Air Base and the area for troops to come. And they stopped to take a break. And a young Afghan girl came over and asked for a bottle of water. My son threw it to her. It hit the ground, and when she stepped forward to pick the bottle of water up, she stepped on a landmine that they had missed, and it killed her. Hassan ran and was holding her body, what was left of her, rocking her.
Levi Derby was born in Cisna Park, Illinois, on May 13, 1981. He joined the Army in 2001 and was deployed to Afghanistan 6 months later.
I was very proud. It was something that my mother and I had encouraged him for quite some time. My father having served during World War II, my great-grandfather was the private guard to Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany. Six generations or more in my family has served. So I was very pleased that he had decided to serve his country. He came home and all he had was a dead stare out of his eyes. He was like the walking dead. Anger, you could see anger in him and a coldness. The happy son that I had known that loved life so much and loved children and animals now would just seem like this shell of a person. Mm-hmm. When he first came home, he was not home long when he was told that he would be shipping off to Iraq. And he could not bear to go into war again. It was something he said he would never do again. He had told me when he came home that he had killed and he would never ever kill again. He just...
Judy realized that her son was going AWOL and convinced him to speak to the base chaplain. Levi was not feeling capable of returning to war and agreed to an other than honorable discharge. Therefore, he was denied medical and mental health benefits of any kind by the Army.
He served honorably. I have it in record. I contested his discharge several times. And the last time I contested it, they agreed that he had served honorably. He had went over as a PB2 and came back as an E3. It was promoted while he was there. Because of his illness that was a result from the war, I believe he should have been given a medical discharge.
Levi was becoming more isolated, not taking care of himself or working and having recurring nightmares about his experience at war. He and his family realized that he was in need of inpatient health treatment and decided that he would go to a hospital in Kankakee. Aware of the high cost of treatment and his lack of health care coverage, when Levi and his grandmother were halfway to the hospital, he asked her to turn back.
She drove him home, and my son had an IROC that he had raced, and he had pulled the engine out of the car about a year earlier, and it hung on the chain hoist. He asked his grandma to help him take the engine off the chain hoist. And she did. She went to church. He tried again to call his counselor on the suicide hotline number. And he had told her that he had gotten almost to the hospital, but not today. And she said, "Well, what about tomorrow?" And he said, maybe tomorrow. But everything's going to be okay. And then he came over here and he wrote his letter telling us goodbye. And he went to my dad's garage and he hung himself on the same chain hoist that my dad had swung him on in a car tire when he was a little boy. And he had felt betrayed by our government, his family, his friends. And he hung himself in my dad's garage, and Mom came home from church and opened up the garage door to find my son. I I think he could still be here today had he been given the proper treatment.
Every day, 22 veterans take their own lives. As shocking as the number is, it is actually higher if you count men and women such as Levi Derby's. Veterans are killing themselves at more than double the rate of the civilian population, with about 49,000 taking their own lives between 2005 and 2011. The question is, why has suicide become such an epidemic? Adrian served as a captain in the Army Infantry and spent 25 months in Afghanistan over two combat deployments. He now works as a journalist, writing investigative articles for the New York Times concerning PTSD and the high cost of war.
The veterans that are most at risk for PTSD, based on my experience, would be those veterans that participated directly in combat operations. I don't think that's even a risk. I think that's probably a direct correlation. I think if you participate in combat operations, then there's almost a one-to-one correlation with you experiencing some amount of PTSD.
Five veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, also known as PTSD.
Yeah, PTSD is a psychiatric disease or disorder that was defined in the early 80s, 1980s, by the American Psychiatric Association, although it was known for many, many years, actually.
Dr. Yuval Nuria, Director of Trauma at PTSD at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and professor of clinical psychology at Columbia University Medical Center, runs one of the country's leading trauma programs working with PTSD recovery.
It's comprised of a number of symptom clusters that mainly includes reliving of the trauma, and here's the idea that patient with PTSD is thinking and feeling and recalling, you know, aspects of trauma in an involuntary way again and again. The second cluster is a cluster of actually trying to be removed from the trauma. So because of the, you know, memories of the traumas and rethinking about the trauma, is kind of activate a lot of anxiety avoidance is a key component of PTSD, and that's why, you know, PTSD patients tend to be removed from society, to be alone, to be lonely, and to be avoidant of any reminders that can be associated with a trauma memories.
A detailed study by the Army Surgeon General in 2008 found that 3/4 of young male troops saw someone seriously injured or killed. More than half were attacked or ambushed, and 88% received incoming fire. These traumatic memories tend to replay themselves over and over in these soldiers' minds. As with Levi Derby, the image of the young Afghan girl in the landmine was something he told his mother that he re-experienced on a daily basis. The constant stress of being in a war zone creates illness. These people witness things that disrupt their sense of inner security, what is right and wrong, creating tremendous inner conflict.
In the military, there is the military story, and that is the story that you are allowed to tell to yourself, to your friends, to your family, and to your fellow, you know, people in the infantry or wherever else. This is what happened, this is what it says on the piece of paper, and that's the way it is. And it's tough to live that reality out in a lot of different ways. I had ideas about what, you know, what PTSD was probably going to be like for me But what it came down to was actually a very innocuous event. They were attacking us, or we were trying to help people, and bad things happened, but they were in the context of a greater logic. That one moment when I was in a field and people were shooting at me, and I decided to run for cover, not forward, but backwards, because the cover was closer to me backwards, and I didn't want to get shot. I still deal with in the present moment. Now I still check the locks, you know, if I'm in a room, if I'm in a hotel room, if I'm in my apartment, I will make sure that the windows are closed, and I will make sure that the door is locked every day. A lot of it was just revolved around, not drinking as much and taking myself more seriously, establishing routines, and writing and storytelling, which is something that I hadn't made a lot of space for. But there isn't a lot of space for storytelling in the military. There's a lot of space for storytelling afterwards, which is probably why so many of the best writers of the 20th century tended to be veterans of World War I and World War II and Vietnam.
Tonight, I can announce that over the next year, another 34,000 American troops will come home from Afghanistan. This drawdown will continue, and by the end of next year, our war in Afghanistan will be over.
Number one, absolute number one, when they take women and men and they send them into a combat zone, when they come back home, their immediate family needs to be brought in and they need to be given contact points that they can go to. They need to be given information. They need to be trained what to look for. They need to be given the help, because they're the number one help that's